Welcome to Family Talk.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to today's edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and I'm so excited about today's guest. She is a friend of mine, a brilliant lady, and her name is Dr. Linda Mintel. She speaks passionately to the heart of people, providing real answers to real life problems. No matter what topic you're discussing, Dr. Linda's fun personality always comes through. Thanks for being here, Linda.
Well, I'm so glad, and you gave me a great endorsement on this
book. Well, it's a fabulous book. It's just such a fabulous book, and I love anybody who knows how to navigate conflict, because most of us don't even like to talk about conflict. So today we are going to be talking about your book that came out a few months ago. It's called We Need to Talk, How to Successfully Navigate Conflict. Can you successfully navigate conflict?
Absolutely. One of the reasons I wrote it is because it's a skill that everybody in a relationship needs to know how to do.
Yes.
And just like you said, Meg, so many people are conflict avoidant.
I think most of us are.
Well, there's a little quiz. You can go to my website. It's just my name, drlindamindel.com, and you can take a little quiz. In fact, I had one of your producers take the quiz, and it'll spit out your conflict style. So it'll tell you whether or not you're an avoider, or you're more of a reactor, kind of a reactionary, volatile person in conflict, or whether you tend to be more of the negotiator. And there's some other styles that
come
up as well.
Are there instigators?
No, that's not one of the styles. There's also a hostile style, which you don't want to be.
Okay.
An accommodator, which is okay to a point, but then becomes problematic. And then that competitive style, which works great on the tennis court, but not so great in real life.
In relationships.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those conflict styles, because I find that really intriguing. What's the most common conflict style among women that you see?
I think the avoider or the reactionary, you tend to be one or the other. So unfortunately, a lot of people like to avoid conflict because it's unpleasant.
Right.
When you have to deal with a problem, there's usually tension. But interestingly, when I was doing the research on this book, people who avoid conflict actually live a shorter life than people who deal with conflict.
Seriously?
Isn't that interesting?
Well, but it kind of makes sense, because do you think that they internalize, they sort
yes.
of just swallow everything, and then they live with that, that angst, or
yeah,
if you will.
Exactly. And what the research shows is that when you avoid initially, you feel better. So you get this kind of initial relief of, oh, I didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah.
But then the next day, your body begins to react, and then you start to feel worse, even worse than if you had not avoided to begin with.
Mm.
So in the long term, avoidance is not a good strategy. And you know, as a physician, that when you carry around things that you're not dealing with, that it tends to release those stress hormones.
It has a physiological
yes.
effect on you.
Yes, yeah. And it does mm-hmm. damage to the physical body, as well as to your emotional life, and certainly to your spiritual life. Because if we look at scripture, and we look at Matthew 18, which is a very common scripture that people look at with conflict, it's really clear that you're supposed to go to someone when you have an issue and not avoid them. So it's not a biblical model.
Why do we avoid?
I think it's just the unpleasantness. People don't want to deal with their differences because they know things could get out of control. Somebody might react badly.
Are they afraid they're going to become angry and not be in control? Or do you think they're afraid of making someone unhappy or disappointing somebody? Well, because if you know I feel that differently from you, then you're not going to like me anymore.
It could be all of those. But if you think about when you grow up in a family, you tend to learn a conflict style based on what you see with the people that are your parents. So if you're in a family and you see two people fighting, and that fighting is very out of control, you might be somebody who avoids conflict. Or you might pick up that habit, and you might be very volatile in your relationships when you start to deal with conflict. So a lot of this is learned behavior. But the good news is, if it's learned behavior, you can unlearn it. And you can do it a different way. But we do tend to learn things. And we know from the neurology of the brain that we lay down these certain patterns in the brain. And they're called neural pathways. And we won't get into all that crazy neuroscience that nobody wants to talk about. But what happens is you're actually laying down these neural pathways in the brain. And that's what creates a habit. And so in order to change it, you have to practice doing things very differently.
So our brains are really wired.
They're wired.
And what you're saying is, so there are our initial responses to conflict and how we deal with conflict wires our brains one way.
Right.
But you say even as adults, we can rewire it.
We can. And that's the great thing about our brain. It's what we call plastic. that you can change things in the brain and you can change those patterns by practicing different behaviors. So the first thing I would tell people is look at, what did you learn in your family growing up? What did you see? What patterns did you see for dealing with conflict? Because that will really give you some idea about how you're going to react in those relationships, because we tend to carry those patterns into then our adult relationships. And a lot of times we repeat, even when we know it's not healthy, we repeat it because it's familiar. Mm-hmm. It's a familiar path.
Yeah. We do what we know, not we do. What we want.
We
yes,
do.
Exactly. Do you think that women have a more predominant conflict style than men, or is it not related to sex?
Well, there are some differences. There are some differences because when women do this, what we call tend and befriend. So we like to have that relationship. It's really important to us to work through issues. So women do like to talk more about when a conflict comes up, and they do want to try to have a conversation, whereas men tend to withdraw a little bit more in confrontation, in interpersonal relationships. Not so much maybe in business relationships, but on your one-to-one, your important emotional relationships. Because they know that women are better talkers. Mm-hmm. So what I've heard in therapy for years, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I've seen tons of couples over the years. And a lot of times the men will say, hey, my wife is just so much better at the talk part of this that I get overwhelmed by what she's saying. And I don't talk. I don't know what to say because I get overwhelmed. And interestingly, there's this great research that actually John Gottman did, who's a very well-known marriage person. And he looked at when people get into a conflict and they get aroused, and they actually put these little, they're called pulsometers, on the fingertips, mm-hmm. and it measures your heart rate. Mm-hmm. And so what he did for years is he measured couples' heart rates. And he found that if your heart rate goes over 100 beats per minute, your brain begins to get flooded and you can't think. Oh. So the part of the brain that has all the emotional controls in it just gets completely captured, and the rational part of your brain doesn't respond. And that's why when people are in conflict, they don't always know what to say. And afterwards, you'll hear couples go, oh, why didn't I say that? Or why didn't I address that? And it's because they're getting so flooded. So one of the things we teach couples is when you're getting so emotionally aroused, because that's the key when we're dealing with conflict, we don't want to escalate conflict, because it's not whether or not you have conflict. All relationships have conflict. Conflict is normal.
Parent-child, marital Any. Relationship, business relationship, friendship.
It's normal. If you're with somebody else, you are bound to have differences. Mm-hmm. But where you get into trouble is if that conflict, it gets escalated. It's how you deal with conflict that matters. And I teach that to people over and over. It's not whether you have conflict. Conflict is healthy. Mm-hmm. You grow in intimacy with conflict. You learn about yourself in conflict. You understand the differences of the person you're with, and you can work through those. But if you don't deal with conflict in a healthy way, mm-hmm. it can destroy those same relationships.
You know, I so agree with you, and I think one of the reasons that I've seen with parents, you know, with their children over the years becoming more and more permissive is they don't want conflict with their kids.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they're afraid that if they have conflict with their children, it'll cause them to separate, to be less bonded, to be more distant. And they're afraid but you're absolutely right, because the truth is conflict, and particularly resolution of conflict, really brings you closer together. It doesn't drive you further apart.
It doesn't. And if you don't do that with your kids, they're not going to learn any kind of conflict model. So then they'll go into the world and they won't have any clue how to work through those conflicts. But it's that uncomfortable feeling that stops parents from doing that. So you know how it is as a parent. I have two kids, and I know you have kids. And, you know, when you take that stand and you go, well, it's just not going to go that way, and you're having this difference of opinion, and the child is very upset, you have to be able to tolerate that upsetness, knowing in your head that I'm doing this for a good purpose, and they're going to have to work this through. So we have to let our kids be upset. We have to let them learn to feel distress.
Yeah.
Because what we're seeing with college-age kids, they don't know how to tolerate distress.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to work through their emotions. They don't know how to regulate their emotions when they become young adults.
I wonder if there are a lot of times when our kids are growing up that mothers sort of wear their kids' feelings, and so kids learn not to be able to tolerate distress because mom's always there, or mom's helping them, or you know, whatever it is. So there are different types of conflict style. Let's talk about handling conflict, conflict resolution 101. And you talk about this in your book, We Need to Talk. So what are the key steps in starting to resolve conflict?
Well, I think it's always a good idea, especially if the conflict is really difficult, to begin it with prayer. Because prayer just calms things down.
With the other person.
With the other person. And especially if you're a marital couple and you hold hands and you pray, it kind of sets the tone.
It does.
Completely differently than if you start a different way.
Yeah.
Because one of the things we know from the research is that you start a conflict with what we call a soft startup. And this is actually scriptural. The Bible talks about a gentle word, turns away wrath. So you begin with a soft startup. So you don't come in and go, you did, and right away with the negativity.
Start somebody on the defense. Yeah.
Right. Start soft. Start calmly. So getting your emotions under control is always a good thing. But the biggest part is to take responsibility for your part of any kind of difference. And what happens in a lot of parent-child couples' relationships is that the blame starts right away. Mm-hmm. So if you can acknowledge a conflict, even if you're dealing with a very difficult person, and you can start the conflict with, look, I probably didn't handle my reaction real well when we started to talk about this. Right there, you're taking responsibility.
And you're disarming the other person, but that requires some humility, doesn't it,
Linda? It does. And I'll never forget, I saw Rick Warren one time at Saddleback Church talk, and he said, if you want to create a great marital relationship, when it comes to conflict, there are seven words that will change the whole dynamic. And what he said was, I'm sorry, I was only thinking of myself. And he said, if you can use those seven words in your relationships with anybody, it totally changes the tone, and that person begins to then listen. And so listening is a big part of conflict, because a lot of times what we do is we sit there and we're rehearsing in our head how we want to make our defense, and we're not really listening to what that person says. And then I think another key is always to focus on, I'm not here to change that person or to change their mind. I'm really here to try to find common ground or some kind of solution.
That's wonderful. So you start with prayer. You own what you're supposed to own. You disarm the other person by saying, I was only thinking of myself. I'm sorry.
Right.
Do you think it's important to apologize early on in conflict resolution?
I have a friend who does a lot of marital research, and he did a study where all he did with couples who were struggling with all kinds of problems and conflicts, he began every session with a prayer and forgiveness right at the beginning. Mm. And he found that half the time he didn't even have to have the session because it changed, again, the dynamic.
Everything.
Because you're getting at, okay, so what does it mean? What does it mean in Matthew when it says that we are to be a peacemaker? I think that people misunderstand this with conflict.
Yes.
Because what they typically think, I'll tell you a story. The first time, when I was early married, my mother-in-law was visiting us, my mother and father-in-law. And my mother-in-law, very biblical, spiritual lady, wonderful missionary. She was a missionary all her life. But she grew up in a family where she was very uncomfortable with conflict, very uncomfortable, and had very abusive family situation. And so she just did not like anybody ever having a conflict. So my husband and I were one time, we were just having a conversation about a Christmas party or something, and we were disagreeing. And we got a little bit loud, but we weren't out of control, and we knew that we would get to a resolvement of this.
Yeah.
She walked in the middle of us, in the middle of our conversation, and she put her arms out and she said, blessed are the peacemakers. And I was like, excuse me?
Blessed are those who resolve conflict.
Right, yeah. But in her mind, a peacemaker meant to not deal with that issue because it was creating tension. But if you look at the Bible, what Jesus did, he didn't appease people just to get out of a conflict. Mm-hmm. He didn't accommodate people to get out of a conflict. He took the issue head on. Now, he did it. He spoke the truth in love, and he had tremendous grace with people. But he dealt with the issue. And then if we go back again into Matthew, and we see where Matthew says, if you have aught against somebody, you go to that person. And then it goes on to say, and if you can't resolve it, you bring in a third party. And you try to deal with it. And then it goes on to talk about how church leadership and other leaders should deal with things. But the model there is to be a peacemaker, you go and you deal with someone. And you show them that we can walk hand in hand and not see eye to eye necessarily in the conversation. Or we can disagree, but we don't have to do that in a disagreeable way.
You know, boy, if we could only, you know, just walk through those few principles, and particularly in the church, because usually what ends up happening is there's a conflict between a couple of people or a disagreement, and rather than go to one another and resolve it, they go to their friends.
Yes.
And so their friends start talking, and ultimately what happens is you pit one person against the other person. So let's role play, if you could, or let's just talk about a specific scenario. Say you're in a church and, you know, there are two women and they're real good friends, and one of the women says something very nasty about the other woman and hurts her feelings. And the other woman finds out about it and hears it and says, I want to go to her and say, I heard that you told so-and-so and this really hurt my feelings or whatever. So one person wounded another.
Right.
How, and that woman who was hurt is a conflict avoider.
Right.
How would you instruct her to go to her friend? What would you say?
Well, first of all, you know, to tell her that that's a biblical model. You've been offended, you've been hurt, so you don't really have the option of avoidance. I mean, you certainly can choose it. You
don't. I'm an avoider, Linda, so this is not good.
Go ahead. I know, but what I would say is that, again, you talk from the I perspective, the I, capital I, not the I in your head. And you say to the person, look, I don't know if you meant it. I don't even know if it's true. So I always tell people, when you go and you deal with something that you might have been offended with, give them the benefit of the doubt. Start with that. Start to say, look, I don't even know if this is true. It may not have happened. You may not have said that. But this is what I heard. And if it is true, it deeply hurt me. Mm. Now, that's very different than blaming the person and going to that person and saying, I heard, what I heard is what you said, and you better not talk to me. And you hear a lot of that kind of approach. And then all it does is make the person defensive. So the key variable when you're starting a conflict is not to start with criticism. You can make a complaint, or you can say what you heard or what bothers you. That's a complaint. That's very different than criticizing someone, because the minute you criticize, there's a pattern that follows. The person gets defensive, and then it escalates, and then there's all this critical talk that begins to get kind of nasty, which goes into what we call contempt, and then eventually people just put up a stone wall and they don't want to have anything to do with each other. Mm-hmm. But if you could get that woman in that church to go directly
to, that
to the
other
person,
woman,
it would save. And let me say this, Meg. In families, this happens all the time, too. You think about it. You're married, and you call your mother, and you complain about your husband.
Yes.
Or your husband complains to his mother-in-law about the wife. We call that in therapy unhealthy triangles. Because in a triangle, at the bottom of a triangle, there's a person and a person, and they're having the conflict. Mm-hmm. But when you bring a third person in and they get in the middle of that conflict, it creates this unhealthy triangle. Mm-hmm. And so the work in therapy is always to kick that point person out and get the two people to talk to each other so that it's direct communication. Mm-hmm. Because you don't resolve the feelings when you're talking through somebody. But it's easier to do, which is why people do that.
Exactly. It's a lot easier to do.
It's a lot
easier.
And it
also, part of it kind of feels good because you're forming an alliance.
Yes. And that's one of the things unhealthy people do in conflict. Very difficult people often find an ally or an alliance or a person that's going to advocate for them, because the goal is to win.
Right.
Not to
resolve.
And especially not to preserve the relationship. And in conflict, what is so important is that you preserve the relationship. And if you do that, whatever happens in conflict, you'll come out stronger in the end in that relationship, because you haven't won the battle. Or the war, but you've lost the battle, or whatever that saying is.
Yep.
In other words, you don't ruin the relationship just to be right.
Exactly. But a lot of us do. Now, let's talk about somebody's response. And sometimes, and I've seen this happen, if you go to somebody and say, I heard that you said this, or I heard you say this, and that deeply hurt my feelings, but then that person you're talking to gets mad at you for expressing that, and they almost try to trump you. How dare you say that? I would have never said that, or I didn't say that, or I didn't mean it, and how can you say you were hurt when I was da-da-da? And they almost sort of, they defeat your point.
Yeah.
What do you do in a situation like that?
Well, what you do is you stay calm, and that's always the key. You're going to hear me say, stay calm, stay calm, stay calm, because remember the little thing on the fingers that gets the heart rate growing.
Right.
When the heart rate is going,
your brain
you
goes
don't
fuzzy.
Hear. Yeah, your brain, it's what we call hijacking the amygdala in neuroscience, which all that means is the emotional center is taking over and the rational part of you cannot think. So you have to stay calm. So a lot of people will do a timeout. sometimes when conflict escalates, they'll take a time out because then they can have time to calm down. It mm-hmm. takes about 7 minutes for the amygdala to settle down mm-hmm. and to calm down. So sometimes you can take a time out. But if you can stay there in that discussion, in that conflict, and you can say, you know, I'm sorry you're so worked up, but this is what happened. This is what I feel. Mm-hmm. And it's what I learned a long time ago in an old book by Harriet Lerner called The Dance of Anger. And I loved that book because it talked about the dance. And yes. all it's talking about is relationship dances, where if you behave differently, it changes the interaction.
Yes.
So what you avoid in that interaction is if you start to get reactive, then you're both just going to get reactive and it's going to get escalated. But if you can stay there, and I tell this a lot, I have a book on mother-daughter relationships and adult daughters, and I talk about this. If your mother starts escalating and blaming you and saying things, if you can just sit there, you can not get so emotional that you can't think, and you can say, but Mom, that's what I was feeling. You're taking your stance, you're taking your position, which is the only position you can control. Can't control what the other person does, but you can control what you say. And you take that position, you're kind, you're firm, you're setting a boundary, and you're saying, this is what I felt. And you say it over and over, over mm-hmm. and over. That dance has to change yep. somehow.
And I love that book as well.
We're old enough that we know that book.
It does date us.
Yes.
But how, when you change your response to someone's anger, it bothers them.
It does, because you're changing the dance.
Exactly. You're yeah. changing the dance. And I remember my dad, rest his soul, used to have an awful habit, and that is when we were children and we would get upset or angry, he would get mad at us for being angry. So we learn not to be angry,
right.
and you don't know what to do with it. And right. that's what I mean by your feelings are trumped by another yes. person's feelings. And I imagine that could work in marriage. It could work in business, where you come and say, I'm feeling this way, and I'm upset, and my feelings were hurt. And somebody comes along and just motors over you. What you're saying is, stand there.
Stay in your position.
And I think that's important. Mm. And make yourself have a strong but firm voice.
Yes.
And say, this is how I feel. And I think a lot of times women have difficulty doing that because we think, well, we just want to please everybody. We want everybody to be happy, so that we need to do that.
Yeah, and I think in that mother-daughter book, because one of the dynamics that you see continuously is that a daughter might try to take a stance on an issue that's very important to her, and the mother will try to guilt her. Or to say, play what I would call the martyr role. Well, you know, but you never come home. Well, I'll never see you. Well, go ahead, do your own thing, do whatever. And the daughter has to be in a position where she so well understands what her point is, her position is, know that she's not being mean or cruel. She's just taking a position. In therapy, we used to call that finding your own voice.
Mm-hmm.
So to find your voice and to have some confidence in your voice. And again, I tell like young adult daughters, pray about it. I mean, if you're just being mean or you're just trying to make a point, but if your point is really legitimate and this is really what you think and feel and you're trying to set a boundary, just stay in that position, but do it. And my mentor, who was at Georgetown years ago, used to say to me, you can do that without getting overly emotional. And you can take a position on any issue without getting highly defensive or highly emotional. You know you've found your voice.
Oh, that's hard.
It was good. I know. It's hard to do.
Yes.
Well, we have to stop here today, but you don't want to miss the conclusion of this conversation on the next edition of Family Talk. Dr. Mintel will continue to talk about her book, We Need to Talk, How to Successfully Navigate Conflict. She'll explain how conflict can actually make relationships stronger if it's handled well, and if we remember that the ultimate source of relational transformation is a loving God. If you want to get a copy of Dr. Mintel's book or to find out about her radio show, follow the links on our website, drjamesdobson.org. You can also find out how to get a copy of this broadcast to listen to or share with someone you know will be blessed by this message. And be sure to tune in for the conclusion of Dr. Meeker's interview with Dr. Linda Mintel on the next edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Dr. Mintel will continue to discuss her book, We Need to Talk, How to Successfully Navigate Conflict. Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
When When you want to offer advice to a person about a flaw or a shortcoming in his or her character, it's best to do it the way porcupines make love, very, very carefully.
Here's Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
It's often difficult to open the eyes of friends or relatives to their own blind spots. It's even more risky to discuss a mistake in the way parenting responsibilities are being handled. You're liable to get your ears pinned back, even when your motives are honorable and you have the other person's interests at heart. Let me offer a suggestion that may be helpful in handling this delicate assignment. The right to criticize must be earned, even if the advice is constructive and desperately needed. Before you're entitled to tinker with another person's self-esteem, you must first demonstrate your respect for him as a person. You have to invest some time and effort in his life, in an atmosphere of love and kindness and human warmth. When a relationship of confidence has been carefully constructed, you'll have then earned the right to discuss a potentially threatening topic. Once motives have been clarified, you can then feed your suggestions and criticism in very small doses. But as you do it, it's wise to keep one other thing in mind. Someone somewhere would like to straighten out a few of your flaws, too.